Well, good morning. We've all walked into this place today with a story. Everyone has a story. What's yours? Everyone has a story. What's yours? Six simple words that form the tagline of an online magazine that began about 10 years ago. It was the brainchild of a journalist named Larry Smith who wanted to create a community for storytellers online. And so he hired two bloggers to travel out across America and get people to share their stories, and then he would publish them on his website. Unfortunately, 4 days into the project, the bloggers bailed. And so he had a website that was up and running with no stories to tell. So he decided that he needed to move quickly in order to keep the momentum going. So he decided to act on an idea that he and a friend had been kicking around for some time that came out of a legendary story involving Ernest Hemingway. You may have heard this story. That supposedly Ernest Hemingway got into a bar bet one afternoon with some fellow writers who challenged him that he could not write a novel in 6 words. And so he took them up on the challenge and he wrote these words: for sale, baby shoes, never worn. And he won the challenge. And so Larry Smith decided to, in the same way, challenge his online audience to write their story, to write their memoir, to capture the essence of their life in only 6 words. And to his surprise, the response was overwhelming. This was called the 6-Word Memoir Project. And these little snippets of humanity came flooding in 6 words at a time. And they were all over the map, from shocking to strange to silly to sad to inspiring. They found that people actually wrote great 6-word memoirs because of the limitation, not in spite of it. And what began as a place to post stories became a community of storytellers, a community that shared their tales of birth and death and love and heartache and challenges and triumphs. Son's autism broke and rebuilt me. Life's GPS keeps saying recalculating, recalculating. Truth be told, I pretend daily. It was the whole spectrum of life, 6 words at a time. Teenagers even got involved in the project. One wrote in, "We're the family you gossip about." Another said, "Living my dream, please send money." They quickly realized that anybody could do this, even elementary school children. Emily Z, age 8, wrote in, "Life is better in soft pajamas," which I think Emily is a genius. But people begin sharing the most intimate details of their life, cursed with cancer, blessed with friends. Interestingly, not written by some optimistic grandmother, but by a 9-year-old thyroid cancer survivor. Larry Smith has since published the best of these memoirs in a book that quickly hit the New York Times bestseller list, and he entitled it, "Not Quite What I Was Planning," and other 6-word memoirs by writers famous and obscure. So I want you to think about it. If I invited you up on this stage this morning and asked you to come up with your story, to capture the essence of your life in 6 words, what would you share with the rest of us? It's kind of an intriguing challenge, isn't it? I want to share with you a few of my favorites from the book. One person wrote in, "Anything's possible with an extension cord." I think that's a practical good one. I could certainly identify with Alex, who wrote, "It was embarrassing, so don't ask." Or Carletta, who wrote, "Never really finished anything except cake." And even celebrities got involved. Taylor Swift wrote in, "My diary is read by everyone." And one final one I'll share, probably my favorite: "One tooth, one cavity, life's cruel." And so I thought about, what would mine be? And this is kind of a work in progress. I'm just going to throw a few out that I've been thinking about that captured my life. Why did I eat all that? It's one. That was delicious. I'll have more. And you can see they're kind of centered around one theme here. But from the looks on some of your faces, maybe I should write, "Does anyone understand what I'm saying?" But what would yours be? And I bring this up because as we continue in our series through the book of John, we're going to look at the story of a man who had an extraordinary encounter with Jesus. And I'm going to argue with you today that the reason this story is extraordinary is not because of the situation that he brings to Jesus, although it is a desperate situation. And the reason this story is extraordinary is not because of Jesus' response, although Jesus will perform a miracle here. I think what makes this story extraordinary is this man's response to Jesus. And I believe that based on it, we could pretty quickly capture the essence of who this man is in six words. Powerful words that transformed this man's life and his heart and ultimately led to the healing that he was so desperate for. And I believe that the same six words have the potential to do the same for us here this morning if we will allow them to become part of our story. My goal for our time this morning is just pretty simple, that every one of us will walk out of here determined to live out these six words from this day forward. And so you're going to want to write these words down when we get to them, but we're not there yet. I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's go to the story and start from the beginning. John chapter 4, verse 43, if you have your Bibles or device, or it'll be up on the screen. It begins like this. After 2 days, he left for Galilee. Now he is Jesus. And it's, geographically, I think it's important that we understand what's happening here. Because when we started this whole series in John, Jesus was in Cana, and it's where he performed his first miracle at the wedding. You remember he turned the water into wine. And so we have a map. Jesus is up in Cana. He performs that miracle. He heads down to the area of Judea where Jerusalem is circled, and that's where he goes down, and he's at the Passover festival. It says many people saw the signs that he was performing, and they believed in his name. This is where he had the encounter with Nicodemus that Barry talked with us about several weeks ago. And now he's headed back up to the area of Galilee. He goes through Samaria there in the middle, and you see the middle circle is Sychar. That's Jacob's well. That's where he was last week when Andy talked with us about his encounter with the woman at the well. And so you have to imagine that Jesus and his disciples are leaving that middle area just so on fire, so inspired by the response that they got in the Samaritan area. Because you remember the woman went back and she told the whole town about what Jesus had done. And it said so many of them believed and they begged Jesus to stay just to teach them a little while longer. And so he agreed to stay for 2 more days. And now he's headed back up to the top. And this is where our passage starts. After the 2 days, he left for Galilee. And then John tells us in parentheses, now Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And I think what John is doing here is he's just giving us some backstory as to why Jesus left Cana in the first place to go down to Jerusalem. Because he had performed the miracle at the wedding, got somewhat of a mediocre reaction to it, and I think left understanding that it's kind of hard to pull off the whole prophet thing in your own hometown. I mean, some of you have seen this at work in your own family, haven't you? That maybe you grew up as a child who was a little bit awkward, a little bit clumsy, had trouble expressing yourself, but now you're an adult. You've gotten an education. You are very successful in your career. You've got your own family. But isn't it true that the moment that you walk through the front door of the house you grew up in and get back together with those people, it's like you've walked into a time warp. You are back as your old self again. Suddenly you're Greg the Goofball or Bucktooth Billy again. And it's hard to get those that you've grown up with to see you differently. But if you can leave and make a hit somewhere else and then return, then maybe people will begin to see you in a different light. And I think Jesus understood that. So he left and he went down to Jerusalem, wanting to gain this wider audience, this acceptance for his message, knowing that the people of Galilee would pay more attention to him if when he returned, he was preceded by a reputation. And I'd say, according to the next verse, his plan worked pretty well because it says when he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, for they had also been there. And once more, he visited Cana in Galilee where he had turned the water into wine. And now enters the protagonist for our story today. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son who was close to death. Now, Capernaum is about 20 miles from where Jesus is in Cana, but this man is desperate. He has probably watched night after night, feeling helpless as his son has suffered with fever and seems to be teetering on that line between life and death. And he hears that Jesus is back in the area, that he's back in Cana, and he's already heard about the miracles that Jesus has performed. And so he heads out to beg Jesus to come back with him and to heal his son. And right away, I think we can connect with this man, can't we? If you've been a parent for any length of time, then you probably already know some degree of what this dad was feeling. For me, it takes me back to 1989, when Kathy, my wife, became pregnant with our first child. And we were excited mostly because our two best couple friends also got pregnant right around the same time. And so we were just thinking, this is going to be awesome. We're going to get to go through this together. These moms-to-be sharing their experiences, the ups and downs of pregnancy as they walk through this together side by side. And us dads-to-be sharing the ups and downs of living with moms-to-be. It was perfect. And then one day, Kathy and I went in for a sonogram. And the doctor ran the probe, and there was no heartbeat. It was quiet. The silence was deafening. And I remember standing there as a dad-to-be feeling kind of helpless. God, I don't know. We need a miracle here. We need you to intervene here, anything. But it wasn't to be, and so we went home, and we grieved for the next days, weeks, months, still excited for our friends, but not knowing exactly how to still engage with them. It was a very difficult time. Wanting God to do what we wanted him to do, thinking that we knew what was best for us. God, here's your assignment. If you have any questions, just let us know. Have you ever felt that way with God? What we couldn't see was that God was still at work behind the scenes as he always is. And within a few months, we were pregnant again. And this time the pregnancy went to term and the morning came for Kathy to be induced. And I'll never forget that morning. We put in our cassette tape of the Gaither Vocal Band, which I know ages me a little bit. But we played this song, and it's still right here at the front of my head. It says, I just feel like something good is about to happen. I just feel like something good is on its way. Now, Jason, if that doesn't get me up here, I don't know why. I mean, I have tried and tried, but we had it belaying all the way to the hospital, and we get there and they induce her, and then it's just like time comes to a stop and nothing's happening, and the nurses keep checking in, and hour after hour pass, and finally Kathy says to the doctor, look, we can go home. We don't have to have the baby today. We'll just come back another day. And the doctor said, no, we're having this baby today. And so we waited and we waited and we waited. And finally there was some activity, but it wasn't around Kathy. It was nurses running in and out saying that the heartbeat's dropping, and then the doctor coming in and saying that the baby's in distress, we're gonna have to do an emergency C-section. And again, those feelings just flooded over me. God, please do something here. We are desperately crying out to you. And so when I read this passage, I can relate to this man. And by the way, I'm terrible at remembering to finish stories, so let me just finish that so you'll know that that resolved. And our son was born. He had his cord wrapped around his neck, but he's fine today. He's here, right here, one of the great joys of my life. But in this moment of this story, I get it. I feel for this man. And whether you're a parent or not, I would guess most of us can relate to this feeling of desperation. This feeling of where everything's going wrong and I have no control over any of it. And the only solution I can see is that I need a miracle from God. Maybe it's your marriage that it's falling apart. It's been hanging on by a thread for months, and you've been trying to be strong. You've been trying to fix it yourself, but you find yourself here this morning and you realize it's not working. Maybe you're one rent payment away from filing bankruptcy. Financially, you're flat on your back. You see no way up. Perhaps it's a wayward child or a child who's involved in things that are breaking your heart, or a broken relationship somewhere. Maybe it's a medical diagnosis. We all know what it's like to feel what this man is feeling. And so our hearts go out to him, and he comes to Jesus and he pleads and he begs, come with me, Jesus, do something for my son. And so Jesus responds. And his response is almost kind of shocking. It's a little bit unbelievable, I think, for us today. Verse 48, it says, unless you people see the signs and wonders, Jesus said, you will never believe. A little harsh, isn't it? I mean, that doesn't sound like the Jesus we learned about in Sunday school with the pictures of the children on his lap and the lamb over to his side. What's going on? Well, you need to see here that the the you people, it's a plural you. In the South, we would probably say you all. He's not addressing this to the anguished father, but to those who have gathered around with him, those who would probably come from the same class as him, this privileged class of noblemen who for the most part were in opposition to the work and ministry of Jesus. And they've just showed up because they want to see a spectacle. They want to see some event, something that they could brag about. They were there when this happened, and then go back and tell their friends. So Jesus calls them out on this. But notice, the father's too desperate to even acknowledge, much less engage in this line of discussion. He immediately brings it back to the need that is overwhelming his heart at this moment. The royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." And that word used for child is very personal. It's almost a pitiful word. You could say, "Sir, come down before my little baby boy dies." I mean, the agony is almost palpable at this point. And so he pleads with Jesus, not, I think, really even sure about who Jesus is, just knowing he seems to have some sort of special power that might help here. And now Jesus responds directly to him in verse 50. "Go," Jesus replied, "your son will live." Literally translated, "your son lives." And so if I'm that dad, I now have some mixed emotions. On the one hand, I'm a little disappointed because you just told me, Jesus, you're not going to come with me. I thought you would come to make sure that my son's okay, and now you're saying you're not coming. But on the other hand, you've said my son will live. And so I'm not exactly sure what to do with that. I've got to decide what to do now. I'm not exactly sure why you're responding this way. And some 2,000 years later, looking back at this story as an observer, I think what Jesus is really doing here is he's inviting this man into a deeper kind of faith. Because if you translated this entire conversation into today's language, it might go something like this. Jesus starts by saying, "Hey, are you one of those seeing is believing type of people? Because there's a lot of people like that in our world today." And this man just says, "Look, I'm just a desperate father. I don't want to argue with you, Jesus, or talk about what class of people I belong to. My little boy is dying. I just need your help." And then Jesus' response says, in effect, "Then believe and you will see." Jesus is inviting this dad into the kind of faith grounded not on what Jesus can do for me, but on who he is. Is Jesus who he says he is? Can his words be trusted? And now we come to this man's extraordinary response. This is where the story gets good. This is what writers would call the arc of the story. Verse 50, "The man took Jesus at his word and departed." A little phrase that we could so easily and quickly just pass by and miss the power of. So I want to say it again. The man took Jesus at his word. See, this is where I realize that as much as I can identify with this man up to this point, this is where we kind of part ways. This is what really doesn't register with me, because if I'm honest, I know that if this were my story, this is not going to be the next line. But for this man, we just discovered his six-word memoir, the words that capture the heart of who he is. This is what you ought to take note of. He took Jesus at his word. See, if this were me, we'd be reading an entirely different story, because my story would probably read something like, "And he heard what Jesus said," or "and he wanted to believe Jesus' words," or "he went away and he studied Jesus' words," or "he tried to figure out what Jesus' words really meant." But here it just says, this man just took him at his word. He just believed what he said. And so I've been thinking over these past weeks as I've studied for this lesson, how different would my life look if I just started taking Jesus at his word? If I really trusted all the things that he has said to me in this book, the promises that he's made to me. See, for instance, when Jesus says back in Matthew 6, "Don't worry about your life, what you'll eat or drink or wear, because God already knows what you need. He'll take care of that." I'm pretty sure I don't live like I believe that. I hear it and I understand it, but truth be known, I worry a lot. Now, you might make a good argument that maybe I don't worry enough about what I eat or about what I wear, but besides those two, I spend a good amount of time worrying. I worry about my kids and my business and my finances and my relationships and my friendships, and I worry about what people think. I worry about what you're thinking right now. I worry about worrying. I'm just a worrier. And then the next line, he says, and by the way, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will worry about itself. Are you kidding me? That's my number one worry, tomorrow, the future. And don't look at me with that puzzled look, because I know you worry too. High schoolers, I know you worry about what college are you going to get into and what are you going to major in. College students, I know you worry about what job am I going to get when I get out of college. Young adults, out of college, you start worrying about, will I ever find a mate to share my life with for the rest of my life? Young couples, you start worrying about, will we have children? How many children will we have? Middle-aged couples, you start worrying about, will our children ever grow up and move back out of the house so we don't have children living with us anymore? And I'm in my mid-50s now, and I finally realize there really is not a worry-free season to this life, is there? The only way to live that way is to actually take Jesus at his word and trust him when he says, don't worry, I've got this. And trust him when he says, I know your situation. Do you know I know you so well that I know the number of hairs on your head, and that he cares for you, and that he holds you in the palm of his hand, and that he's got a great plan for your life, and that regardless of what comes your way, his grace will be enough for you. That even if everything you're praying for this morning never comes to fruition, he promises that he will be enough for you. Do you believe that? Can you take him at his word? Or what about in Romans 8, when he says that famous passage, all things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Do you believe that? Listen, I am so thankful that I grew up with a mom who from an early age just drilled that into me. All things work together for good. Because when we went through our miscarriage and then through a C-section and then later through another miscarriage, I couldn't see it at the time. I certainly didn't need someone in my face saying Romans 8:28 to me, right? But you know what? I didn't need to, because I already had that planted in my heart. And now looking back some 27 years later, I can testify to you today that that is true. That promise is true when I see the good that God brought out of that very difficult situation. Friendships that were formed. Some of our best friends for 27 years, that friendship was birthed during that time because they showed up on a Sunday afternoon with a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, and we sat on the floor around a coffee table and we cried and we prayed and we laughed. Our marriage was strengthened. Our faith was deepened as we realized, you know what? The only thing we have to hold on to here is Jesus. These promises are true. And this man took Jesus at his word. But it's the next line that really blows me away. And he departed. And he departed, that he walked away, that he just headed back home, trusting Jesus enough to just leave. See, the next line in my story would be, he kind of believed, but he certainly stayed around and continued to beg Jesus to come with him. Which sadly kind of reveals just how little I really do take Jesus at his word. See, the evidence of real, genuine faith is found in the turning around and taking the first step and then the next step, to be willing to act on it, because I can say I believe all day long. But if I just stand there and I never walk, then I really don't believe what I say I believe. It's what James, Jesus's brother, was getting at when he said, don't merely listen to the word and deceive yourselves. Do what it says. In the same way, faith by itself, if it's not accompanied by action, it's dead. Can you imagine how hard it must have been for this dad to just turn around and walk back home? He had traveled 20 miles just to try to convince Jesus to come with him. I'm pretty sure his wife had told him as he walked out the door, don't even think about coming back into this house unless you have Jesus with you, or you will wish you did not come back to this house. And this wasn't 2017. He didn't just hop in a Prius and make a 15-minute drive over to try to convince Jesus. He had walked 20 miles, probably took most of the day. And now he had to turn around and take the same long, lonely walk back home, holding on to nothing but the promise that had been spoken by Jesus. And I'm sure at this point he had to be thinking, this doesn't make any sense. I thought Jesus was going to be coming back with me. How's this going to work? I mean, he had to be confused, but in spite of all of it, he just did what Jesus said. What if we, as a community of faith, decided to do the same today to take Jesus at his word, all in, that we're gonna live our lives from this day forward submitted to the words that are written in this book, even when it doesn't make sense, even when it looks absolutely crazy to the culture that we live in, that we have just decided to trust that maybe Jesus knows what's best for our lives better than what we know. So when God says to you young people, keep yourself pure, that sex is a gift, but it's a gift for marriage, that you just take him at his word in that he wants what's best for you. Or when he says to us, I want you to be generous with what you've been given. I want you to give regularly to the work of building my kingdom. Yeah, you know, one day, God, but right now we're really busy and we've got student loans to pay and we're trying to pay for a house and we've got kids' school we're thinking about, maybe in a few years. Look, do you trust him or do you not? What if all the husbands in this room decided to take him at his word and love and serve our wives like Christ loved and served the church? And what if wives decided to honor their husbands, whether they deserved it or not, just because Jesus said it? What if children decided to honor and show respect for the elderly? What if we took seriously the call for justice and taking care of the widow and the orphans and those less fortunate than us, those marginalized in this world? What if we started with something as simple as showing up here on a regular basis each week to worship together, like it says in Hebrews? Don't neglect meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encourage one another even more as the day of Christ draws near. What if we actually did that? See, I read these reports that say the average church member shows up 2 out of 4 times on a Sunday. Why? God has already said, you need to be here. And it's not because he's got some big ego and he's trying to figure out, can he pack in more on a Sunday morning than Adele can on a Saturday night? That's not it. He knows we need it. Your children need it. We need to be encouraging one another, worshiping together. We need to be listening to the word of God taught, because you don't know what's coming up in your life. You don't know what unexpected circumstances just around the corner, but God does. And today may be the day that he's trying to equip you for a day that you don't even know about. A wiser man than me once said, hey, when it comes to being at church every week, you just make that decision once. Just make it once. You don't wake up every Sunday and try to make that decision. So I'm making your life simpler for you right now. You've just taken one decision off your plate for this next week. You decide it once. See, I want my 6-word memoir to read, he took Jesus at his word, and that people will know it because I actually lived like I believed it. Because that's when we allow God to pour out his blessings in our life. I want you to see how this plays out as we finish this story. John 4:50, the man took Jesus at his word and departed. And while he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that this boy is living. Same exact phrase that Jesus had used when he said, your boy is living. And when he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday at 1 PM, the fever left him. And I love that John included that little part of the story, because it helps me to relate again, that there seems to be this sense in him that, yes, I believe, but I just want to verify this. Exactly what time did this happen? And they tell him it was the same time that Jesus spoke to him. And that's when this transformation happens. Verse 53, then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. So he and his whole household believed. This man's entire family was changed. The trajectory of the generations that would come after him was forever altered, because this one man had the courage to make a decision to take Jesus at his word. And God says to us today, that's what I want for you. That's what I want for your family. But it starts with trusting me fully with your life. Will you, from this day forward, take me at my word? Commit to actually do what it is you hear me saying. Trust me, so that I can bless your life and pour out these things that I want to give to you. It's what James meant when he said, the one who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues to do this, not forgetting what he has heard, but doing it, he will be blessed in all that he does. That is a powerful promise, isn't it? And if you reverse that thing around a little bit, the truth of this passage, I think, becomes all too clear too quickly. Because isn't it true that the parts of your life that you wish you could erase, the memories that you wish you don't have, the events that you hope no one ever finds out about in your life, the relationships that you wish had never happened, isn't it true that most of that could have been avoided in your life if you would have taken him at his word and acted on it all those months ago, years ago, 20 years ago. See, the truth is that for most of us, our souls would be in much better condition today, not half as wrecked with things like greed and lust and anger and all the things that bring havoc to our lives, if we would have just trusted him enough back then to take him at his word. We spend so much time and energy trying to rationalize and reshape and twist what God has said. Did he really mean that? In order to fix it so that we can live our lives the way that we want to. Well, what if we spent that same effort trying to reshape our own hearts and our lives to align with what he's already clearly spoken? To start today, taking him at his word from this point on, committing to do what he says. Nike said it best, just do it. Even if it's hard, even if it costs you something, even if it's embarrassing, because I know it's hard to apologize. It's hard to remain faithful in a dead marriage. It's hard to move out of a living situation that's not honoring to God or to take responsibility at work for a mistake that you've made. But God says, you trust me and you do what I ask and I promise you, you will be blessed for it. Simple trust followed by obedience. Jesus said in John 14, if you love me, show it by doing what I've told you. Are we willing to take that step? Because I would guess everyone in here knows something that God is asking you to do right now, and you are still fighting him on it. We're arguing with God over stupid stuff that should have been settled a long time ago, and it's time for us to let go. We don't need to learn anymore at this point. We just need to start doing what we already know, to trust him enough to take him at his word. I got recently such a sweet picture of this kind of trust. A couple of years ago, one of our friend's sons was getting married and they didn't have a home church, and so they asked if I would do the wedding. And my first thought was, I don't do weddings. I don't do weddings, and there's a good reason I don't do weddings, because one of the first weddings I did was my son's and his bride, and I wish I could say it went off without a hitch, but it didn't. I was in the middle of giving my charge and thinking that this was the most exhilarating, powerful speech I could ever give, and people must be on the edge of their seats in anticipation to the next word I'm about to say, and all of a sudden I hear a, and a bridesmaid has completely passed out over here to the side, just flat out on the ground. And so I didn't know what to do. I really had not done weddings. So I just froze and I just stood there and smiled at my son and his bride. And time passed, and luckily out of the corner of my eye, I saw the silhouette of a door open on the side of the platform, and a person's silhouette come out, grab the bridesmaid like this and scoot her out. As her feet go out the door and the door closes, then I just continued on with the wedding. Probably not my best moment, so I don't do weddings, but I had known this family for a long time, and it was kind of a unique story. The bride had been diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in the year before, and she was in a state of remission, and so I agreed to do it. It was part of their day. It was a great celebration. It went off without a hitch. At least everyone stayed standing, so I called it a success. And then 2 years passed, and it became obvious that her story wouldn't be ending like we had hoped and prayed for. The cancer had come back with a vengeance, and after 18 surgeries and 38 rounds of chemo, her body was giving up, and they had to place her in hospice. And so we went to see her, Kathy and I went to see her, and she asked if I would officiate at her funeral. And I immediately felt the panic run down my spine again because, well, first, I don't do funerals either, so just know that. But I knew this one was different. And so we had this long talk about what she wanted that day to look like, a conversation no 26-year-old should have to be having. And I asked her how she was managing with it all, and she said, look, I'm really fine. I know I'm going to heaven. I'm just worried about the people I'm leaving behind. And I've grown so much closer to God through this whole thing. I used to take him for granted, but now I just need him. And so I have to talk to him every day. It's really grown in me and my faith. And it was just this beautiful talk. And so when we were done, I got up and I said, well, is there anything else you need to tell me or any questions you have? And she paused for a minute and she said, there is one more thing. I accepted Jesus a long time ago in my heart, but I was never baptized. And I just feel like I want to be baptized before I die. And so my response, well-meaning, was, you know what? I think God's fine with that you haven't been baptized. I don't know why I thought I could speak on behalf of God, but I was like, you know what? Because you have tubes and, you know, all the things that go on in a hospital. I thought, I think God will be, he just cares about your heart. And she said, I'm not worried. I want to do it. And I'm glad she talked me out of me talking her out of it. And so the next weekend, her family flew in and we went down to the chapel and I had the privilege of baptizing her. It's a moment I won't ever forget. And the picture that's forever ingrained in my mind is how at the end of the celebration, she smiled and she just started clapping. And so the rest of us joined in clapping. And I left that day so moved and inspired, witnessing this simple childlike faith, this brave young woman who just chose to take Jesus at his word, said this is what he's asked, and then acted on it. And I left that day praying that I would have that kind of faith, that whatever he's asking of me, I would be the first to step up and say, I'm ready. You just tell me, Jesus, I'll do it because I trust you. A few weeks later, her body finally gave up. And she took her last breath and she walked into the presence of her Savior. And the funeral was scheduled and I struggled with what am I gonna say for days. I thought, what do I have to say to two parents who have just lost their only daughter? What do I say to, how can I comfort a 26-year-old young man who will be going home to an empty house? And so I just prayed, God, you have got to give me something to say. I need some words here. And very quietly in my spirit, I felt him saying, you don't have to come up with words, Craig. I've already spoken the words over this situation. I just need you to remind people, death has been defeated. I am the resurrection and the life, and that for her and everyone else who believes in me, though they die, they will live again. And that you need to tell them that I'm preparing a place for her and for everyone else who calls on my name, a place where there will be no more tears and no more sadness and no more death and no more pain. And oh yes, will you let them know that I'm very close to the brokenhearted? And Craig, you should know. And could you tell them what I reminded John of in Revelation 22, that these words are trustworthy and they're true and you can count on them. You can stake your life on them. You can take me at my word. Now go and live like you believe it. Every one of us has a story. What's yours? The life you are living today is writing a story. And don't you want a great story? No one wants, I worked hard, then I died. No one wants, I built a really big house. I drove a really cool car. I binge-watch Game of Thrones. Those are not great stories, and yet they're what many of us are living. Today can be your day. Today can be the day that you turn the page and you change the plot line, and you begin a new story that starts with these six words, I took Jesus at his word, and then see what happens. I promise you it will make a great story. It will. And now, we're going to come to the table and we are going to celebrate one of the greatest stories ever lived. The story of a God who loved this world so much, who loved you so much, that he sent his one and only son, Jesus, to this earth to live a perfect life and then to go to a cross to pay the penalty for our sins. And on the last night he was together with his friends, they gathered around a dinner table and they shared a meal together. And Jesus took the bread and he blessed it and he broke it and he said, this is my body that's been broken for you. And then he took the cup and he blessed it and he said, and this is my blood shed for you. It represents the new covenant. It represents this promise that I am making to you that you can count on, that I will be back for you. And we will share this meal together one day. And that's what we're coming to celebrate, that we can take Jesus at his word. And the altar will be open. Maybe today's the day you need to find someone at a blue candle who's praying and just ask them, will you help me with this? Will you help me pray that I am ready to give up? I am ready to give Jesus the reins. I'm going to trust him at his word from this day forward. If you have trouble managing the steps as we're released by rows, just raise your hand. They'll come serve you the elements at your seat. But this is our time to honor him.